Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Queen on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. Doug Rao will be joining me. He is the founder and president of Daily Table and past president of Trader Joe's. And he will be joining me in just a little bit. But first, of course, I want to share with you some things going on in the news, some ways that you can take action, and of course, my weekly recipe. So this week, after having a very successful CSA fair 2 weeks ago, I was getting bombarded with emails of people telling me that unfortunately they missed the fair, but could I share with them the list of farms? And so I put together a list of all the farms that I know of that have CSAs, and I can't say that it's 100% complete, but it is all the farms that I know of on Long Island that have CSAs, that or have farmers markets, or farm stands at their farm. So there were 32 farms that I came up with. One is just two are poultry farms, but they also sell other things. One also raises grass-fed lamb, and one is poultry and lamb, and one's 100% grass-fed beef. So anyway, but most of them are vegetable farms, and they run CSA programs, and they're great people, great places to get connected with your local food system. And supporting our local economy is absolutely wonderful. Connecting with other people that buy into the CSA programs, is a wonderful way to expand your community and find other people that care about the foods they eat as well as you. And so it's just a wonderful model. So anyway, if you missed the fair, you can go onto my website at IE Green and get a list of all the CSAs here on Long Island. I'm sure, there's people putting together lists all across the country. We have over 7,000 CSA farms in this country, and I think it's even more than that at this point, but that was the last statistic I could find when I was looking that up. But anyway, it's a wonderful, wonderful model. So look into getting your vegetables that way, or growing your vegetables. If you are someone who is thinking about growing vegetables for the first time, this is the time you want to start getting out there and getting your garden set up. You want to be ordering your seeds and getting going with that. This time of the year, every year, I share with my followers who get my newsletter the Dirty Dozen list. And that's the Environmental Working Group's list that they publish with the newest Dirty Dozen items that they have on it. And the Dirty Dozen are the 12 most important vegetables to purchase organically. And they also have a Clean 15 list, which are the least sprayed and least toxic vegetables out there. So when you're shopping, if you're really trying to make a decision as to whether it's worth spending the extra money to buy something organic or not, these guides can really help you. And the Environmental Working Group has lots of different guides. And another organization, cornucopia.org, also has great scorecards. So it's really wonderful to do your research when you're shopping. I understand that organic is more expensive most of the time than non-organic. Sometimes it's only a little bit, and it's certainly worth it. Sometimes it's a lot more. And so making an educated decision as to whether this is worth spending the extra money for you is important to have. However, buying organic, just, if you can afford it, it is always the way to go, because it is guaranteeing not only that you are getting less chemicals and pesticides into your body, but it's also supporting those that are growing vegetables in a way that is not adding to our climate problem and is actually helping. When you grow vegetables organically, you're also helping to sequester carbon into the soil. And it's just a much better way of doing things. So our current food system is really broken. We will, probably talk about that at some point in our conversation today. But this is something that is really worth doing, educating yourself on those most toxic vegetables that you want to avoid, and fruits, and making a, you know, educated decision. I also wrote in my newsletter this week about Medicare for all. There's a real push, you know, with the pandemic, we have seen how those that are already coming to the table with pre-existing conditions and poor health are much more vulnerable to negative outcomes from the COVID virus. And most of these chronic illnesses are diet related. It's amazing how diet makes a difference in our health. It's not a cure-all for everything, but chronic illnesses like obesity, high blood pressure, heart disease, osteoporosis, high cholesterol, stroke, rotten teeth, tooth decay, and even some cancers are linked to poor diet. And so improving our diets really can improve our health care. And right now, the way our whole system is set up so that it is good business for us to be sick. Okay, a lot of people make money, pharmaceutical companies, hospitals, doctors, everyone makes money when we're sick. If our government was paying for our health care, it would behoove them to keep us healthy because it would save them money. And then they would invest money in keeping us healthy and ban things like sugary drinks like soda or diet sodas. I mean, that whole thing when they were trying to ban sugary sodas but allowing diet sodas would not be a very good solution, because diet soda is worse for you than sugar soda. So, you know, we really need to clean up our food system. And I think having a Medicare system for all is really one of the first ways to start doing that. And I can tell you personally, you know, this year during the pandemic, you know, my income certainly dropped. You know, I no longer am cooking right now at the school for the farm to school, as the farm to school coordinator. My private clients have, you know, mostly canceled at this point. You know, people are cooking at home. I was doing cooking classes, you know, offering them for free online. So that was not a financial stream. I've been working with my husband, which is helping, but his business also. So many people really took a cut this year during the pandemic and have been feeling it financially. And so when I went on to renew my insurance and saw how much it was costing me, I went on the open market to take a look. And we make too much to get any type of support from the open market, but we certainly don't make enough to pay the outlandish fees. I mean, it was over $1,000 for each of us a month. And, you know, that's $24,000 before tax dollars, right? Before tax. So, you know, that's, you know, a third of my income. I mean, it's just, it doesn't make sense. And we really need to fix it. We cannot afford to keep it going the way it is. So please sign on to support a Medicare system for all, so we all have access to healthcare at an affordable price. I want to share with you this week's recipe. I made a gluten-free, actually not gluten-free, I'm sorry, a vegan gefilte fish that is just wonderful. And let me see if I can pull it up here. Okay, it's a mock gefilte fish. And for years, I've been making a gefilte fish loaf, which is different in that I bake it in the oven as opposed to making dumpling type things and boiling it in a fish stock, which is how traditional gefilte fish is made. But this gefilte fish loaf, everybody loved. And so this year, you know, I no longer eat fish and I wanted to come up with an alternative. So this really came out great. I will continue to work on it and make it better every time, I'm sure. The amount of arome that I put in here to give the fish flavor was not as strong as I actually would like. So I'm going to up it. I used 1 cup in my original recipe, but you might want to try adding 2 cups. That's what I'm going to do when I make it this weekend. So this is the recipe. I used 1/2 yellow pepper cut into strips and 1/2 red pepper cut into strips, 2 carrots cut into thin circles. Actually, 1 carrot was enough. It was such a big carrot. I didn't need it all. 1 pound of firm tofu, 1 tablespoon baking powder. Like I said, I used 1 cup of arame, but give it a try with 2 cups of arame if you want a stronger fishy flavor. 2 tablespoons kelp powder, and that also you could up to 4 tablespoons if you wanted to try that. 2 tablespoons of flaxseed, 2 tablespoons apple cider vinegar, 1/4 cup of water, 2 medium-sized onions, 2 medium-sized carrots, aquafaba, the juice from 1 can of chickpeas, 2 tablespoons canola oil, 1/2 cup of matzo meal, 1/3 cup of chopped parsley, 3 tablespoons of chopped dill, 1 teaspoon salt, and 1/4 teaspoon white pepper. And so what I did for first is you want to prepare 2 loaf pans. I baked them in, you know, a bread loaf pan. And to prepare it, you want to line the bottom with wax paper. So first spray the pan with a little bit of spray oil, then line the bottom and the sides with wax paper. Then decorate the bottom of the pan with the strips of peppers and the circles of carrots. And that ends up being the top of the pan when you invert it, when you invert the loaf after it's baked. You're going to decorate, so that's the decoration for the bottom. Then you're going to pour boiling water over the arame, so whether it's 1 cup or 2 cups you're using, and let that sit until most of the water gets absorbed. So you want to cover the arame with the boiling water. Meanwhile, in a food processor, you're going to pulse the carrots and the onions until they're well chopped. Then you're going to drain the arame and add that to the food processor and pulse that as well. Then add the rest of the ingredients except for the aquafaba and pulse all of that until it's well blended. Transfer to a large bowl, and then using an immersion blender, put the aquafaba in a small bowl and beat that up with the immersion blender until you get soft peaks like you would with egg whites. And it will double in volume and it will turn white and it looks just like egg whites. And you're going to fold that into the arame mixture. Then you're going to gently spoon a few spoonfuls over the vegetables that are in the bottom of the loaf pan so that you don't disturb the decoration. And then fill the rest of the loaf pans with the rest of the mixture. Cover the top. Well, first smooth out the mixture in the loaf pan so it's smooth. Cover the top with a piece of wax paper cut to fit. And you first want to spray the wax paper with a little bit of oil, the part that's the side that's touching the loaf pan. And then bake it in an oven at 350 degrees for about an hour. And you'll see it will firm up, the edges start pulling away. And you remove that from the oven, score the edges with a knife, and then you can invert it onto a plate and let it cool. And that is it. And then I made a horseradish sauce with it, which I use 1/2 cup of vegan mayo, 1/4 cup of prepared horseradish, and I squeeze the water out of the horseradish first, the prepared horseradish, so that the sauce is not too runny. And then I also add 1/4 cup of fresh grated horseradish to really give it a bite. Then 1 tablespoon of organic ketchup, 1 teaspoon of lemon juice or more to taste, some pepper to taste. And if you'd like it spicy, you can add some sriracha sauce or some red pepper flakes or any other hot sauce that you want and make that mixture. And that's really great. It's also great just being served with fresh prepared horseradish. You can do that as well. And it's delicious. If you get my newsletter, you saw the pictures. It looks really beautiful. And I hope you all enjoy it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest this week. Doug Rao is the founder and president of Daily Table and past president of Trader Joe's. Doug spent 31 years with Trader Joe's company, the last 14 of it as president, helping grow the business from a small 9-store chain in Southern California to a nationally acclaimed retail success story. He developed their prized buying philosophy, created their unique private label food program, and wrote and executed the business plan for expanding Trader Joe's nationally, successfully leading the expansion to the East Coast in 1996. He graduated from Trader Joe's in 2008. And then he founded Daily Table, which is an innovative retail concept designed to bring fully affordable nutrition to the food insecure in our cities through utilizing the excess wholesome food that would otherwise be wasted at growers, manufacturers, distributors, and retailers, and through special buying opportunities. Daily Table currently has 3 retail stores in Boston. He serves on the board of Sprouts Farmers Markets, Imperfect Foods, and several other profits and nonprofit organizations. He's a founding board member and was CEO for 6 years of Conscious Capitalism, which is an organization dedicated to the practice of business as a force for good. And we'll be talking more about that as we get into our conversation today. Doug was a recent senior fellow at Harvard University in their Advanced Leadership Initiative, and he was inducted into the Babson Academy of Distinguished Entrepreneurs in 2015 and was awarded the James Beard Lifetime Achievement Leadership Award in 2018. He lives in Newton, Massachusetts, and I'm so happy to have him with me today. Hi, Doug.
Hey, Bhavani. Nice to see you. Let me first check. I am on the audio call-in on my headphones, or I am on the laptop speaker. What would be the best way, sound quality?
Stay on the laptop speaker so I can also see you. I like that.
All right, great. You got it.
Okay.
Well, nice to be here.
So thank you so much for taking the time to join us. I thought maybe you could first just share a little bit more of your history. Like, how did you first get involved in the food industry?
Yeah, well, actually, it was a friend of mine who, after I graduated from college back in 1973, said, hey, listen, while you're waiting, I applied for grad schools. And while you're waiting, I could use your help down at our warehouse. And I thought, oh, what kind of thing is this? Oh, it's this natural food company called Erewhon that was founded in the 60s by Paul Hawken and Michio Kushi. And so they had a manufacturing plant and mill and packaging and retail stores out in Los Angeles. And so I said, I'll come down and check it out. And I thought, you know, I don't want to go work for some warehouse after I've, you know, gone to college and go unload wheat bags and things like that. But I went down, and it was this interesting group of young, very, you know, idealistic, very, interesting people. So I said, well, you know what, I'll try it out. So I actually worked there for about 3.5 years, became vice president, general manager. And then Erewhon was sold, Los Angeles, to a different, because Erewhon Boston ran into some economic trouble. And like most early natural food companies, they had religion around food, but no business sense. And I think that the LA was sold to someone that just in my opinion, didn't have the same passion around food, didn't really enjoy that. I started looking, I've been selling to this company, this little company in Los Angeles that was kind of a weird company. I mean, they sold all this wine and beer and stuff, but they're really interested in natural food. It was called Trader Joe's. So I started selling to them Erewhon products. And when I left Erewhon, I went to work for Trader Joe's. This was back in 1977, and got involved with the retail part of food grocery in 1977, helped them create the private label food program, and was there for a number of years, then was asked to write their business plan, how we're going to grow outside of California, which I did, not realizing at the time that, and I was going to be asked to then lead that charge, because my wife had been born and raised in California and I had my family and all my friends there. And so when it's like, okay, here's the plan. We're going to go to Boston, 3,000 miles away, and we're going to start there and then spread throughout the East Coast. They said, okay, great. You know, when do you leave? And it's like, well, wait a minute. You asked me to write the plan. I mean, there's nothing about me leaving. So anyway, after some intense conversations, both with my wife and then within the company, I moved to Boston in 1996 to bring Trader Joe's to the East Coast. We opened our first stores here in June of 96 and then spread them out throughout. We opened in Scarsdale and Long Island in the end of winter of 96, November and December. And then, you know, continued to spread it. I got very involved with the geographical expansion of Trader Joe's, you know, bringing them, you know, around the country. And then in 2006 became the president nationally when we were at the time East Coast, West Coast, and the president of the West Coast retired, and they merged the two and got rid of the East-West idea. And so for several years, I was president nationally, handling all the real estate and the buying and products and all that. And then, as I said, I retired, though, since I flunked retirement and actually don't really believe in traditional retirement. I like to say I graduated, which is more of a celebratory thing. Anyway, in 2008. So that was it. I got, yeah, you know, the joke is, of course, I've had a lifelong relationship with food. You know,
sounds like you never made it to graduate school.
Well, I did make it to graduate school.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Now, I ended up in 1991. I suddenly woke up one day and went, oh my God, I think this is my career. I mean, like Trader Joe's and like I'm a grocer. I mean, how did that happen? I thought it was going to be, I don't know, a scientist or a something, or I didn't know what it was going to be, but somehow just a grocer was not quite what I had in mind for my life trajectory. But I said, I don't know anything about business. I got an undergraduate degree in history. So it's like, I better go get some background in business. At the time, Peter Drucker, who was one of the luminaries of the 20th century for business, kind of the regarded as the father of management theory and things like that, he was teaching at Claremont University, where I had gone to Claremont High School and had lived in Claremont for a while. And so I reached out and joined their executive MBA program, and then got to know Peter Drucker pretty well. Turned out he was an avid shopper and fan of Trader Joe's. And so I did get my executive MBA there at the Drucker School of Management eventually.
Okay. Uh-huh. Oh, good. Well, that sounds like you would have needed that to do that business plan that you put together, because most of my listeners, I can tell you, shop at Trader Joe's, love Trader Joe's. You know, it's really a nice compliment to have with Whole Foods. You know, as I started at the... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, they're a great company. I do think that they, you know, that the two of them, it's funny, you know, that I think that they have made each other better companies. You know, they've competed, they've challenged each other. Certainly, I think prices have dropped at Whole Foods because of Trader Joe's. And certainly, I think that Whole Foods has kept certain standards in food and environment, et cetera, at a high level that has forced Trader Joe's to pay attention to that. So I think they both have challenged each other. And that's what the heart of capitalism is, really, is competition, where the customer, in theory, wins out, as long as there's a really competitive environment. And I think the Whole Foods and Trader Joe's are a good example of noble competitors that have, over the last 30 years or 25 years, pushed each other to be, better representations of what customers want.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. So what was it like bringing Trader Joe's 3,000 miles away across the country? How did you do it? How was that experience?
That was a little tougher than I thought it was going to be. It was very interesting. I chose Boston, not New York, because Boston was a smaller town. As a college town, I thought that, frankly, at the time we were talking about that our prime customer was an educated customer, not a rich customer. Whole Foods looks for income. We look for education. The two of those actually in a Venn diagram pretty close. You know, the higher education levels tend to be higher income levels, but they're not the same. So to me, I looked at Boston, which has like 76 universities around or colleges around, 20 mile radius, and said, well, first of all, we can get up off on the radar because it's a small, big town. Unlike New York, where in New York, you go from three or four stores and hardly anybody would hear of you. And the media for advertising is extremely expensive in New York. It was much more reasonable in Boston. So we started in Boston, and, it was interesting because the vast majority of people had no idea what a Trader Joe's was. I mean, a few of them were like, oh my God, this is so great. You know, I visited your stores when I was out visiting my grandson or my kids or something. But for the vast majority of people, it was like, who are you guys? And I mean, why are you in Hawaiian shirts? So I tell the story on, but it's a true story that So someone that I knew as a business friend was Tom Chappell, the founder of Toms of Maine. And I'd known him through Erewhon back to, 73, 74. And Trader Joe's had done some work with him, private labeled and things with Toms of Maine. And so when I was thinking about coming to Boston, I knew that Tom was from that area. I actually wasn't at the time clear that Kennebunkport was a very different world than Boston. But what are you going to do about your food offerings? Because you can't come to Boston and sell frozen fish and all those frozen entrees and, all that Thai and Mexican and, that's just not going to sell in Boston. And I thought, oh, dear. And he said, what are you going to do with those Hawaiian shirts? I mean, good God. I mean, I understand here in California, it makes sense. You're near Hawaii and stuff. But you're going to look like a bunch of clowns running around in Boston in Hawaiian shirts. And I said, what would you recommend? He said, those nice embroidered kind of yellow bean shirts. It's got like an embroidery on there over your heart that'll say Trader Joe's, And I just thought, oh God, And I went home kind of depressed from the dinner. And there were several other things that he mentioned. I thought, oh man, what are we going to do? And then I thought about it for a second, said, look, we either got to be who we are and we're going to go succeed being who we are, or we can't just become somebody different. So either we're going to succeed doing what we do best, or we shouldn't go. And having been to Boston a number of times and stuff, I said, I think Trader Joe's will do well here. I really do. So we came back and we, gallivanted around in our Hawaiian shirts. And, of course it did raise some eyebrows at first. And, but as with, anywhere in the nation, people like good food and they like getting good value for it. And they like being treated with respect and having a fun shopping experience. Because as we both know, shopping tends to be a chore for most people. And it's on the list with doing laundry or yard work. And the more you can make it fun or interesting or enjoyable, the more people will come in and spend some time and explore. And Trader Joe's is well known for their treasure hunt, the kind of, hey, what, let's go down and see what they got this week sort of thing. And so that's, so that was an interesting experience. I still remember opening the store in Westport, Connecticut, right across from where Paul Newman had cooked up Newman's Own there at the deli right across the street. And I remember standing outside with a vendor who was doing a demo inside the store when we opened. And we were chatting just out in the parking lot. And I looked across and there was this couple coming out of the deli and they're about to get in their Jaguar. And the woman says something to the guy and the guy runs across the street, looks in the front door and yells back, hardware, and runs back across the street. And I thought, what? Heart? Like, and the song I played back, she said, what is that? I mean, go check that out. What is that Trader Joe's thing? He runs in, he looks in the store and either was totally confused, I have no idea why he said hardware, or just said, oh God, we're going to spend another hour in here if I'm not careful. I'm going to say hardware. And later on, I'll just say, well, it looked like a hardware store. So anyway, I thought, hardware? What the heck? Anyway, so it was, there were a lot of people that had questions like, where's the service meat counter? And how come things are in your label? And where, where's the regular spice section? And, to teach people that, hey, we're not that kind of store. That was a lot of education.
Mm-hmm. Couple questions I have, and I'm sure this has come up when you've had conversations with people, is one, the packaging. I mean, I love Trader Joe's, and, I love when you say you want people to have fun. I mean, even the labeling, the writing, the print that you it's not a printed out label. It looks like handwritten by, an artist, and it looks creative and colorful, and it has a much more fun vibe. But all the packaging is in plastic. And, with the problems of plastic in our environment and the feeling like Trader Joe's is a conscious company, are they doing anything to, and I know you're not there anymore, so you might not be able to answer this. And it wasn't as big a problem when you left back in 2008, or it was, but it wasn't on the radar as much.
Exactly.
Are they doing anything now to try to bring in products and let people bring their own bags? I'd love to see us moving in that direction.
Yeah, Bhavani, as you said, I'm no longer with them. It's been 13 years since I was there. Yeah. So it's a long time. But I've read that they've made commitments, toward reduction of plastic. I notice that, I mean, and you're right, there was a lot of plastic in the store when I was there. It just wasn't on the radar as much.
Right.
We were
right.
starting to look into the plant-based and the, you know, soy and corn-based plastics that were then compostable and, you know, not just recyclable, but compostable. The challenge with that is there's many things you can't put in it, you know, that you can't use in that. It doesn't create the same barrier or it interacts with the food in a different way. And so what I do notice is in the produce section, there are a lot more, like the tomatoes are in those almost like egg carton style packages
right.
now with just plastic on the top to seal it. And sometimes even just even then they've got a whole paperboard carton with maybe a little window of cellophane. And cellophane tends to be fairly compostable and I mean, that type of cellophane. So I know that they're doing what they can. I think the entire industry, I mean, for that matter, the entire world is struggling with what do we do to replace plastics. John Oliver this week just had his special, you know, for his This Week Tonight special was on plastics. And it's an eye opener. I mean, it really is. It's not just the food industry. I mean, try to avoid plastic in your life. And it's like first of all, you can't drive a car. So because cars are mostly plastic now. And it's a challenge. So in food, I would say that from what I know, from what I've read and what I'm experiencing as a customer, they're certainly trying to move it forward. I will note that, you know, every grocer, I mean, I occasionally shop, you know, obviously at Whole Foods and everywhere else, there's a lot of plastic in Whole Foods. I mean, a lot of plastic. So every grocer is in a dilemma. And the dilemma is that there either aren't viable alternatives any longer, or they're heavy and expensive like glass. I don't think there's been a new glass plant built. Certainly when I retired as Trader Joe's, at that time, there had not been a new glass plant built in America since 1962. So give you an idea that glass is on the way out and plastic's on the way up. So if you wanted to return to glass for a lot of things, I don't think there's capacity. You'd have to go out and build a whole bunch of new plants. And by the way, glass on an energy kind of a energy footprint, carbon footprint is not so great because it takes a lot of heat, you know, and a lot of energy to create glass.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it's not a simple problem, I guess, to solve.
I know it's not. Otherwise, it would be solvable.
And I don't think it's a question of them not caring. I don't think it's that they're tone deaf. I think it's really that, man, this is a tough one.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And another question I have also about Trader Joe's that you also might not be able to answer is, I know they make a blanket statement that none of the Trader Joe products are GMO, have GMO ingredients, but nobody seems to be willing to verify that, or they don't put that down in writing. Do you know if that's accurate?
Well, it was accurate when I left. That was accurate. We took a position of two things. One, because of all of the problems with quality control out of China, we made the tough decision to not source anything directly out of China. And we ended up having to go everywhere else in the world to find things. And sometimes China was the cheapest, but they're having such quality control problems. Back then, that's when the melamine was in the, you know, pet food things, and there's just all kinds of problems. So we made the decision we're not going to source anything from China until they can really get their act together on food safety and quality. Second was, none of our private label products will be GMO. And we had to go out and spend a lot of energy and time resourcing, particularly corn, soy, and a number of oils to then be certified non-GMO. The challenge at the time when I was president, when I left, was that there are such powerhouses of Monsanto and others that are very big in GMOs that had worked with the USDA that said you could not state something was non-GMO. You could not put that on your label unless it was organic. You couldn't say that your private label was non-GMO because the USDA said that would imply that somehow this is better or different. And we don't regard GMOs as unsafe, so therefore you can't say that it doesn't have it in it. It was a weird,
interesting
position, but that was the position: is you could not declare it on the label, as like you know, no preservatives, no artificial colors and flavors. You can say that, but you couldn't say no non-GMO unless it happened to also be organic, because that was one of the standards in organic. I don't know. Actually, I'm not up to speed on where Trader Joe's is on their private label on that now today. I haven't read or heard about any changes, but I suspect, I suspect that like anything else, there's a real debate on GMOs still going on in the food industry.
Right, right. Yeah, so they still stand behind that and say that it's non-GMO, but that they won't, you know.
And by the way, it's very hard. I mean, just I'll just share from my own experience when I was president there. It's very hard to come up with standards because, first of all, there isn't a common world standard. At the time, Japan had a standard that allowed for it because there's a certain amount of what's called genetic drift. So you may have a field of corn that's non-GMO, but because of corn is pollinated by the wind, you can have a field, you know, sure, a mile away where there's some genetic drift. So Canada had a percentage, Europe had a percentage, and Japan had a percentage. All three were different as the percentage of genetic drift that they would allow to be non-GMO. So if you went and tested something and it came back that said 5% is GMO, in some parts of the world, that's like, okay, that's fine, it's still non-GMO. In other parts, no, it's got to be 2%. So there was no standard that was universal and was agreed upon. So just coming out with testing standards was a trick. And so, I think that we as a country have sort of, not really addressed this issue. We just really haven't confronted it clearly.
Right. Okay, well, now I want to move on to what you're doing now, because what you're doing now is really exciting and really addressing food equity and food insecurity issues, which are so prevalent in this rich country of ours, which should not be a problem. What led you to start thinking about food insecurity and tell us about Daily Table?
Yeah, you know, I mean, having spent my career 31 years, actually 35 years when I count Erewhon, in the food business, I knew that we had tons of product. I knew there was plenty of food to feed everybody in America. And we're a net exporter of food and have been my entire life. As a matter of fact, Ivani, you and I probably are the first generation of human beings to walk on the planet Earth who at no time in our life did we ever worry, does our country or society have enough food to feed us?
Right.
So my parents came out of the Depression, the Dust Bowl, and the famous waste not, want not. Food's a precious resource. You know, for me, frankly, it was think about the kids in China. Think about the kids in India. It's like somewhere else. America was always like, we got more than enough food. And that's an unusual, by the way, experience in human history. So to not worry about famine or drought or pestilence, you know, wiping out supplies and things like that. So I started with the fact I knew there was a lot of food out there. And when I was going into Harvard to start this fellowship, was about around trying to tackle some major social ills. I didn't know what I was going to do, actually. And I was fine with them. You know, come explore things. One of the billboards on the Mass Pike as I was driving into Cambridge from where I live in Newton, at that time, this was right after the Great Recession. So it was 2010. We're right in the middle of it. It was January 2010. So it was really in the depths of it. One of the billboards said, 1 in 6 Americans are hungry. It was a billboard put out by the Greater Boston Food Bank in association with Feeding America. And I drove by that a couple of times when I went, what? How can 1 in 6 Americans be hungry? Like, good God, that's just, you know, that's like 50 million Americans and hungry? That's just something's wrong with this picture. So I decided to lean into it and start to learn more about it. And, you know, one of the first learnings I had, which was an important one, was that hunger isn't what I thought it was. I mean, hunger historically is when you aren't getting enough calories and you look emaciated. And we've all seen pictures of that around the world. And certainly when I was growing up, the care program, you know, and the care packages and all these things that were done when I was a kid. So hunger, that's what hunger was to me. And my first learning is in America, obesity is the face of hunger. It's an oxymoron because the hunger is a shortage of nutrients.
Two sides of the same coin.
Not calories, exactly. And so what it is that hunger is in the form of food insecurity, means that you're not able to afford the foods you should be eating. Almost everyone, not everyone, but almost everyone in America. Now, COVID's a little different because we had some real disruption of supply chain stuff and economic dislocation. It was very severe. But up until then, certainly hunger in America was more about a healthy meal than an empty stomach. It was about how the stomachs were already full, but they're filled with, you know, calorically dense and nutritionally poor foods, sodas, sugar. I mean, there are food deserts in America, no question about it. But we are in a sugar floodplain everywhere in America. There is nowhere in America you can go where there's not plenty of sugar or heavily processed food available. And the challenge is they tend to be cheap. And you can start with the farm bill and, you know, how we subsidize, you know, corn to allow for high fructose corn syrup, which has become pervasive in almost in everything. And so as I looked at this, first learning was, wow, hunger isn't what I thought it was. It's not just get them something to eat. It's get them something good to eat. And then because of that, we've got skyrocketing diabetes, obesity, you know, heart disease and all these other things, which are diet related. And the vast majority of the hypertension, heart disease and diabetes are all diet related. And there's tons of data on that. So then the problem is solving that became much more difficult because solving the problem of getting nutrients to people is a little different than just get them something to eat. And so my next step was then to look at, well, I started, you know, interviewing and asking questions. One of them was with the CEO of Feeding America at the time. I had a couple of hour-long conversations with Vicky Esquerra, who was CEO of Feeding America at the time. And it was through Vicky that she opened my eyes to one of the critical elements, which was she said, and when I asked her, what are your main challenges that you face? And one of the ones she mentioned was, well, for instance, here in, you know, in Illinois, where she was at the time, that in Illinois at that time, 38% of the population that qualified for SNAP weren't using it. So we find the same problem with food banks is that people that qualify don't use the services. It's like, well, why is that? I mean, is it language or distance? They can't get there. And she goes, oh, no, Doug, it's so much simpler. They're ashamed. They're embarrassed. They don't want a handout. They want to provide for their families. And that issue of dignity is so profound that, you know, as I like to say, that people are hungrier to keep their dignity than even their health. And so the idea was that, okay, if we're going to try and solve this issue of hunger, which now is represented by a nutritious diet, we've got to do it in a manner that instills or is a dignified exchange.
So that was so amazing. I just want to interrupt you for a second because so many people who, you know, don't like welfare or Medicaid, you know, food stamps, and they're, you know, not into supporting the poor, have this impression that these people just want handouts.
Yeah,
you know, and it's not true, right?
No,
right.
It's not true.
I just needed to add that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think people have a different perception.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And it's one of my big learnings is that one is that almost no one feels good about a handout. Everybody, and so we've now been doing this almost 6 years now, operating our stores, and the amount of feedback we get from people that go with tears in their eyes, I can now provide for my family. I can provide for my family what they need to eat. You know, I had someone come in, a gentleman came in and went to our assistant manager and said, hey, you look like you're new here. And he said, yeah, I've just started a couple of weeks ago. And he said, well, I want to tell you something. Since this store opened, I've been eating lunch here. And I just traded out my lunch and I eat lunch here. And it's just clean. We meet all the nutritional guidelines of Harvard School of Public Health and Boston Medical Center Children's Hospital. We put together a nutrition panel to give us how much sugar, how much sodium, how much fat, you know, all that should be in the foods we're producing in our kitchen commissary. And so he said, I've been eating what you've been producing here for lunch. And I want to let you know, I've lost 75 pounds in 3 years. Wow. And the guy said, whoa, that's amazing. That's great. No, that's not the best part. I just came back from my doctor's appointment at Common Square Health Center, and I've now been a year off of all my diabetes medication, and I'm fine. He said, you got your life back. Whatever you're doing, keep doing it. And the guy literally had tears in his eyes. And it's those sorts of anecdotal stories that, of course, let us know two things. One, that the community is responding, which we know. But two is you can change behaviors if we remove the economic barriers. Because one of the big problems in America is that it's not enough to put a supermarket down in a food desert if you don't make produce and nutrients affordable. So Daily Table's goal was, how can we make a nutritious meal economically agnostic to junk food? How do we have fruits and vegetables and clean, you know, entrees and soups and salads and, you know, and protein and dairy all be affordable, that someone who's already buying soda and chips and, you know, and having that as their caloric intake, how do we compete with that? So we're a nonprofit, and the reason we are is that that allows us to then go out and get food donated to us from manufacturers and some retailers, but mostly manufacturers, because we don't sell anything for the dignity purpose. We don't sell anything out of code. So one of the challenges of the original model I had was to go around and collect product and sell it a day or two past its code date. It's still perfectly good, but, you know, we get it donated. We can offer it super cheap. And, you know, I didn't at the time fully appreciate how profound the need is in particularly lower economic and inner cities. They're always feeling, we get the seconds of everything. We get the hand-me-downs. We get the used clothes. We get the everything. I don't want food that's like out of code that was going to be in somebody's dumpster that you're selling to me. Why can't I get first-rate product? And so we decided instead to go to manufacturers, you know, like Danone yogurt or Chobani or others that have yogurt that when it gets to within like 17 days of their code date, they can't ship it to a Stop and Shop or to a grocery chain because it takes too long to work through their distribution cycle, get on the shelf, and then have a customer look at it and go, oh, wait, there's only 4 days left on this code. And then they do what everybody else does. They reach to the back and go for, well, is there a longer coded product? So when that product reaches 17 days, it becomes, in essence, expired to them. That is expired food from a manufacturer. I can't ship it. It's now either trash or pig food. So we'll either get that donated, we'll buy it super cheap, and then we turn around and offer that at deep discounts. So that's the model of Daily Tables. Go out and get as much food as you can donated or at super low pricing, and then buy a bunch of other stuff. We only carry healthy food. We don't carry soda. We don't even carry fruit juices, because fruit juices, according to our dietitians, are basically soda without carbonation. The sugar levels are through the roof. You should eat an apple or eat an orange instead of drinking orange juice.
Right.
You know, that's their point of view, and we've adhered to that.
So how much of your product is prepared foods? Because, you know, when you gave that story of the gentleman who was buying, is eating at your store, I think one of the biggest barriers as well is time. For so many people who are food insecure, they're working two jobs at minimum wage to be able to support their families, even with junk food. So the time to cook is a real issue. And I've seen that a lot. And so it seems like
you're way ahead of me. You're way ahead of me. I did not know that. In my brain, 11 years ago, I thought that, hey, if you're down at the lowest economic rung, you probably have more time. And the answer is, oh my God, no, it's the opposite. You're working two or three jobs. You often are taking public transportation because you can't afford a car. And you might even be single head of household. So the first thing is we did focus groups before we opened on how can we best serve you? How can we make sure that what we're trying to design here is what you need? And one of the first things to come back was, hey, look, it's great. You're going to go collect all this food and come down and offer it to us cheap to come in and buy and go home and cook. That isn't going to help us much. And it's like, what do you mean? I mean, what are you talking? Well, what would help? You know, when I get off the bus at 6:30 at night, I need to have food in my hand when I walk through the front door. So I go to, you know, there's a KFC right across the street from our first store and McDonald's right down the street. So I go and get either, you know, some fast food, or I just get snacks. You know, I get a bag of chips and some other things at the corner market, the bodega. And if you really want to help me, you'd have a meal that was delicious and fresh, but didn't cost a nickel more than what I was going to already spend, you know, out there on fast food. So that's what we did. We then had to rechange our model. We put in a kitchen commissary that generates, you know, more than 20,000 servings a month or items. So every day, for instance, you could walk into a Daily Table today in any one of our three locations and get a meal. We have both vegan and, you know, meat-based products, but you get, for instance, a chicken meal, clean chicken. There's no, it's not fried. It's not, you know, it meets all nutritional guidelines, seasoned, but two pieces of chicken with brown rice, with mixed fresh vegetables, a complete dinner for $1.99, freshly prepared.
Wow.
Never frozen. This is fresh. You can get a big garden salad with, you know, tomatoes and carrots and cucumbers and, you know, beautiful lettuce for $1.99. And that's in the large clamshell. You can get it then with salmon or stuff like that for, I think, $3.99. You can get large 24-ounce cups of soup, white bean and kale and feta tomato, stuff like that for $2.99 for 24-ounce. So these are all freshly prepared. So people can come in and get tasty, delicious, fresh meals, freshly prepared at prices that are actually, frankly, less than fast food. I'm astonished at how much a what does McDonald's call their burger? I don't even know. A Big Mac.
Quarter pounder or Big Mac.
I mean, it was a Big Mac or whatever it was. And it's like $5 for one of these. You know, and for $5 as well, you can get yourself several meals. It amounts to, you know, it was running around 20-25% of our sales. Produce is the biggest thing. We do offer through the Double Up Food Bucks program with the city and with Fair Food Network and with support from the GusNIP funding through the USDA. We're able to offer anyone on SNAP 50% off all their fresh fruits and vegetables up to a limit each day, but they can come shop every day if they want and hit that limit again. So that
can they use those food bucks for the fresh food for the meals as well?
It's off your EBT card. It's off your SNAP card. All you do is when you pay with SNAP, you automatically get 50% off all your fresh fruits and vegetables. And Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition did a longitudinal study to see what the effect of that was. Dramatic. They went back over 250,000 transactions and were able to show that from the time for the couple years before we had Double Up Food Bucks to a couple years afterwards, that when we introduced that program, the average SNAP recipient that shopped with us purchased 29% more fresh fruits and vegetables, which is a dramatic increase. That's not anything near, statistically insignificant. It is a huge increase. And they shopped with us 15% more often. So they were buying more and buying more frequently. So it was, once again, proof that if we remove the economic barrier, many people will really increase the quality of the food and do the right thing. So Daily Table also, we hire from the community. We pay $15.69 an hour because that's Boston's living wage. We offer health insurance and EAP programs. So we try to create an economic benefit to the community by good jobs. We have about 70 employees. And then we recover food. We've recovered
that's great.
Almost
so
8 to 9 million pounds.
My next question is it replicable? Can someone take that model and learn from what you've done and open it here on Long Island? Let's say I wanted to do that. Can I?
It's close to replicable. The only thing that's not replicable, I mean, there's everything about it's replicable except for the food sourcing. It takes some knowledge and experience and training to go out and find, you know, the food that's available. And that again is trainable. So we, for instance, had a franchise with a restaurant chain in Los Angeles that was already to be set. We had franchise agreement. There's no payment on that because we're nonprofit. It's just we were going to give them our IP and help them understand exactly you know how to do this. And then COVID hit, and they had a site picked out. And COVID economically, you know, was a disaster. So that set us back. But no, we actually think we can do a franchise style model, or even just I talked on the phone all the time to people or in Zoom that said, hey, we got this idea. And we want to, and I'm more than happy to share my learning, you know, what I've learned, what we did right, what we did wrong, and help people move forward. Because this is a serious issue that, unlike Alzheimer's, where we're not quite sure, even if you have it, until we do an autopsy, or what the solution is, this is something we can solve. We have the food. All we need is the will as a society.
That's amazing. We're almost out of time. I just want you to touch on this other organization that you were a founding board member of called Conscious Capitalism. I mean, we really have like 2 minutes, but if you could
The two minute pitch on that would be simply that I'm a big fan of capitalism. I think capitalism as an economic model is the greatest invention of the human mind on how to create and exchange goods. The challenge with capitalism, as it's often practiced, is it turns into capitalism. And it's the financialization, the short-termism that happens. And conscious capitalism is around that businesses should first and foremost be based not just on maximizing shareholder return. That's one of the worst things that ever came up, is it's not based on, you have many stakeholders. You have the environment, you have your community, you have your customers, you have your employees. All of those need to get value and need to win. And if you have a stakeholder model as compared to a shareholder model, and then second, you have a sense of purpose that's deeper than just making money. And, you know, there's many ways in which business can, and many businesses are, forces for good. And we need to have capitalism be an economic model tied with a value system that is around generating actually win-win-wins for all these stakeholders.
Right.
That's what conscious capitalism is about.
Well, I just want to thank you, Doug, for your work. It's amazing. You know, you're really making a difference. And that's what we all have to do. You know, while we have our time on our planet, we all have to do what we can to make a difference to better our society and better our world. So thank you so much for your contributions.
Bhavani, thanks for the chance to talk about this.
Thanks. And everyone who's been listening, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green. And my guest has been Doug Rao from The Daily Table. So nice to see you all. And I'll be with you all again next week. Have a great Passover if you celebrate. And see you next week. Bye for now.